So the subject today is the triple foundations of Vedanta philosophy. Now, this triple foundation is called, technically it is called in Sanskrit, prasthana traya. Means prasthana means source, foundation, the original source. Now, in Indian philosophic tradition, and especially in Vedantic tradition, the original source, the genesis, not only theological but even philosophical genesis of Vedanta philosophy consists of three important canons, called triple canons. I won't call the names but canons. The first one and the most important and the foundational canon is the Upanishads. The second canon is the Bhagavad Gita, and the third one is Brahma Sutra. These are the triple foundations or triple canons of Vedanta philosophy. So, when you read Swamiji's complete works, all of you must have read, when Swamiji expounds different ideas related to Vedanta philosophy, he repeatedly asserts that I have preached nothing but the Upanishads. You would find this Swamiji repeating again and again, I have not preached anything but the Upanishads. Swamiji has quoted from no less than 8 Upanishads profusely, and also from other Upanishads from time to time. His maximum quotations are from Kathopanishad, then Chandogya Upanishad, then Svedasadara, and fourth Brihadaranyaka, and then of course there are quotations from Mundaka Upanishad and so on. So, what is the importance of these Upanishads, which is the foundation of even the other two canons? In fact, Bhagavad Gita itself is supposed to be a commentary on the Upanishadic philosophy. Bhagavad Gita gives us a technology, a methodology, which helps us to practice the philosophical ideas expounded in the Upanishads. So I shall deal with these topics in a very, I can't do it in a very elaborate way within a very short span of time, and unfortunately I'm a bit late today because my wants deceived me rather, you know. So I shall just draw your attention to certain philosophical parallelisms between Vedanta and European thoughts. But that may help you to get a clear view of what exactly these triple foundations imply in Vedantic tradition. Now, in Western philosophic tradition, there is an element of contrast between theology and mysticism on the one hand and philosophy on the other. And also there is a contrast between theology and mysticism. You can find this very often. In fact, that was why during the Middle Ages, independent philosophy, rational philosophy, philosophy as a search for truth, as Plato defined it, practically vanished from Europe. Philosophy was held captive by theology. Independent thought was not allowed. after Constantine's conversion into Christianity in 305 BC, there was no independent philosophy, independent thought in Europe. On the other hand, even during the pre-Socratic period and during the period of Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, up to Democritus, 2nd century AD, you find independent thought flourished in European intellectual scene. But later on, theology held philosophy captive, and philosophy was not allowed to flourish. Later, from 18th century onwards, there was a revolt from within, a revolt from empiricists and modern humanists and also utilitarians like Hume, Locke from Britain, and also J.S. Mill, Jeremy Bentham, and all these empiricists revolted against the tyranny of theology. And they tried to get out of the tyranny of theology. They tried to get an independent expression to philosophy in Europe. This was from one angle. From another angle, Kant, Hegel, and others also tried to get out of the shackles of theology. They wanted to go back to the pristine golden era of philosophy, which vanished from 3rd century onwards after Christianity became the national religion of Roman Empire. And again, Marx, Engels, and others also came from another angle, political thought, political ideology, and so on. Now, in Vedantic tradition, incidentally, interestingly, you find there was no contrast, there was no conflict between mysticism, theology, and philosophy. That is a special, unique feature of Vedantic tradition. I shall give you an example. You know very well that Shankaracharya is the most prominent name in Vedantic tradition. Now, you know what Shankaracharya defines philosophy. He says, Srutya, Yuktya, Swanubhutya. Means, I shall explain in English. Sruti means revealed texts. That's related to theology. He says, you make use of revealed texts, Upanishads, Gita, or any of the great philosophical texts. You make use of it, but don't accept blindly. Open questions. Subject theological ideas to ruthless rational thinking, rational analysis. That's why he says yuktiya. Yuktiya means through reasoning, through independent questioning. So you should subject revealed texts to independent reasoning, independent questions, through reason. You should try to find out what exactly is the true implication of theological texts. He doesn't disregard, he doesn't reject the place of revealed texts, but he says they should be subjected to rational analysis. You are not asked to believe blindly. You are rather encouraged to ask questions. So throughout the Upanishads you find there are long dialogues, debates, questions and answers between disciples and teachers. Disciples were not just allowed, they were encouraged to ask questions and subject the teacher's instructions to close scrutiny, rational, logical scrutiny. So the second element, Shankara says, yuktiya. Shruti means the revealed, the great revealed texts like Vedas, Upanishads, etc. Yukti means reason, logic, independent thought. It doesn't stop there. Then he says, Swanubhuti means one's own intuitive experience. So you accept the revealed texts, But you are not asked to believe blindly. You are allowed to ask questions. You are allowed to subject the teachings and instructions of revealed texts to close scrutiny, rational analysis. You are allowed to reject if you don't accept. And then, whatever you accept, you must translate into your own subjective, internal, intuitive experience. So you find there is a synthesis between the theological, the philosophical, and the mystical in Vedantic tradition. So that's why there was no conflict between the rituals, mythology, and philosophy. Those who laid out rituals, external conventions like going to a temple, going to a church, going to a place of worship on a fixed day, praying, sacred reading, fasting, and all the celebrations, whether you do it on a particular day or during certain special seasons, certain months which are supposed to be sacred. You do that, rituals, but then that is only the beginning of religion. So Vivekananda once said, rituals constitute the kindergarten of religion. That's what Swami Vivekananda said. And in another context, he said, rituals, doctrines, dogmas, and symbols constitute the kindergarten of one's spiritual life. It's the beginning. So, and then mythology. Even the writers of mythology also said that mythology is not to be taken in toto, not seriously. Behind mythology, behind mythological stories, there are certain deep implications, certain philosophical ideas. You take them and you leave out the outer skin, the story part, and then philosophy. Now, I shall come directly to these triple foundations. So this is one important point to be kept in mind. In Vedantic tradition, there was a harmonious synthesis between the theological, the mystical, and the philosophical. You can begin with theology, but you should not end there. What you begin with theology should ultimately take you to the highest intuitive mystical experience. As I said earlier, Upanishads are the foundational text in the Prasthanatraya among the triple canons of Vedantic tradition. Upanishads contain eternal universal truths related to the origin of the universe, the ultimate meaning of human existence, and so on. So you find here the ideas which Plato may have discussed, Democritus may have discussed, are already contained in the Upanishads. I mean that philosophical approach is embedded in the Upanishads. But then the Upanishads do not stop there. The Upanishads do not reject the theological elements. You may believe, but as I said earlier, first revealed scriptures, sutya, yuktya, then reason, which takes you through philosophy to the highest mystical intuitive experience. Now, whatever ideas, these eternal, universal, spiritual truths are discussed in the Upanishads, are subjected to rational analysis in Brahma Sutras. Brahma Sutras is the logical dimension of these triple canons. If the Upanishads constitute the doctrinal, rather the foundational dimension, I mean the original source of ideas, Brahma Sutras try to rationally analyze the different aspects of these doctrines enshrined in the Upanishads, and then try to come to certain conclusions based exclusively on the basis of reason. So revealed scriptures, revealed texts are subjected to ruthless logical analysis from different angles, from different philosophical angles. I would tell you, there are no less than 12 commentaries on Brahma Sutras. And if Shankaracharya's commentary is the most well-known today, it's because after he wrote his commentary, all the previous commentaries practically vanished because people stopped reading them. And remember, they were not available in written form. They were all transmitted through oral tradition. So when scholars stopped reading the earlier commentaries, they practically vanished. Some of them are, of course, still available. And the three important commentaries available today and studied with great devotion are the commentaries by Shankaracharya, who lived between 778 AD and 810, that is about 32 years, and Ramanuja, who lived in the 12th century, and Madhvacharya, who was a younger contemporary of Ramanuja, who lived a little later. Their life coincides just by a few years. But then there are certain other commentaries belonging to different systems of Indian thought, there have been schools of thought who believed Shiva, one deity, as a supreme reality. They're called Shaivas. Then there have been schools belonging to Chaitanya school. Baladeva wrote a commentary on Achintya Bheda Bheda, one school of thought which believed that ultimate reality is beyond cognition. So it is a combination of dualistic and non-dualistic aspects. So it is beyond cognition. Like that, there are a number of other commentaries, but I am mostly here concerned with the Vedantic commentary, that is the commentary of Shankaracharya. And as time permits, I shall refer to Ramanuja and Madhva as well. Now, in Brahma Sutra, there are altogether 555 sutras. Now, what is a sutra? Sutra is a pithic statement. It will be difficult for an uninitiated student of philosophy to understand, but you have to remember, there have been a host of great Western scholars who devoted decades to study and translation of these books. So, Brahma Sutras contain 555 sutras. There are different verses, 554 also can be accepted, divided into four chapters. Each of the chapters divided into four subsections. And in all days pithi statement, the author, that is Vyasa, tried to give a logical analysis, a logical interpretation to the statements of the Upanishads, mostly statements from Chandogya Upanishad. This is the importance of Brahma Sutra. And as for Gita, which you are already, most of you are familiar with, Gita contains 700 verses taken from a huge work, classical work, which is not purely philosophical, half mythological, half hearsay, and also half philosophical. There are philosophical ideas, high spiritual ideas, and also a lot of mythology. The name of the book is Mahabharata, which contains 100,000 verses. And Bhagavad Gita is a tiny fraction, a portion of this huge classic, which contains 100,000 verses. I shall come back to Upanishads because that is a foundational book. The Upanishads have an interesting story, especially from the standpoint of a Western student of philosophy. Most of you, as I said earlier, have read Swamiji's words, but Swamiji repeats again and again, asserting that whatever he taught came from the Upanishads. If you look, these are Swamiji's words, if you look, you will find that I have not preached anything other than the Upanishads. So Swami Vivekananda was perhaps the first spiritual interpreter of Upanishadic philosophy to the Western world. But the history of introduction of Upanishadic philosophy to Western intellectual culture has a longer history. In 1656, between 1656 and 57, 50 Upanishads were translated into Persian from Sanskrit. The Mughal emperor Dara Shikoh was the eldest son of Shah Jahan. He is the builder of Taj Mahal, which most of you must have heard. So Shah Jahan's eldest son was Dara Shikoh. He was a very broad-minded person. And he invited 10 great Sanskrit scholars from Benares, and with their help, he got 50 Upanishads translated from Sanskrit into Persian. Now, you should remember, right now, 222 Upanishads are available in print form. Some of them are available only in translation form. But 180 Upanishads are available in full Sanskrit text. Now, this prince, Dara Shikoh, who was a very broad-minded person, who was inspired by the Sufi mystical tradition of that age, invited 10 great Sanskrit scholars from Benares to his court, and he encouraged them to translate these 50 Upanishads, including the 10 Upanishads which were interpreted by Shankaracharya, which is the source of modern Advaita philosophy, non-dualistic system of thought. That took place between 1656 and 57. But it was not known to the Western intellectual world for a long time. In 1801, a great European scholar, according to historian, he was of a French descent, translated these 50 Upanishads from Persian into Latin. This took place in 1801. Now, after some decades, the great German philosopher Schopenhauer happened to read this Latin translation. And he was the first great Western philosopher and intellectual who appreciated the greatness, the metaphysical, spiritual uniqueness of Upanishadic philosophy. And he was struck by the fact that Upanishads address mankind, humanity. And Upanishads contained a spiritual philosophy. We did not divide mankind into those who believed in God and into those who did not believe in God. And Upanishads described a spiritual tradition which goes beyond heaven, which asks you to find out your own truth by turning the inquiry inward. So, innumerable statements are attributed to Schopenhauer. Of course, a full-fledged German translation took place only in 1882 by a great German scholar whose name is Hendrik. And this is Even now, this is supposed to be the best translation available in German, which is equaled only by an equally great translation by Paul Deussen, who translated Upanishads later into German language. In 1884, Max Müller translated many of the Upanishads into English. And from that time onwards, you find Upanishadic thoughts started influencing Western intellectual world in a very big way, influencing thinkers and philosophers everywhere in the Western world who dare to come out of the shackles of theology. So it gave them a great hope, a great boost, because they felt that there is a religion which goes beyond religions. Because religion, as understood and defined traditionally, was something which was close to theology, close to belief in a well-defined, well-structured God in whom you are asked to believe, with whom you can communicate only through an intermediary, whom you can reach only by following certain mechanical conventions and customs and rituals. But through the works of Hendrik, who translated the Upanishads into German, and also through the translations of Max Müller into English, Western world suddenly came across a philosophical and spiritual system which goes far beyond the accepted theological doctrines. This is the uniqueness of the Upanishad. I have dealt with the contents of Upanishad on many occasions earlier. As I said, Upanishads deal with certain fundamental questions of human life, the purpose of human life, the meaning of existence, and again the mystery of existence, the meaning of human existence, and also the mystery of the existence of the cosmos. From where does this world come? Who sustains this world? What is the ultimate destiny of this world? All these questions are dealt with in the Upanishads. One classic example I can quote, and then I shall come over to Brahma Sutras, which perhaps we have not discussed on this platform in earlier occasion. Now, Upanishads we have discussed on many occasions, previous occasions, but I shall just refer to one interesting aspect to substantiate this sense of inquiry, this independent search for inquiry. In the Taittiriya Upanishad, there is a discussion between a son and his father. The son's name is Bhrigu and father's name is Varuna. So the boy one day comes to the father and asks the question, what is the source of this world? He didn't ask the question, what is the efficient cause and what is the material cause of the world? Because you have to remember, Upanishad system is the only philosophy in the world which tells you that the efficient cause and material cause of the universe is the same. That is something very interesting. Well, if you believe that you are this body, you have to think of a God who creates this world of which you are a part. But as you evolve more and more, you understand that there is something beyond this psychophysical mechanism, which is impersonal, which is immanent, which is transcendental. And then you realize, well, if the reality can only be one, if reality is only one, then this world cannot have a creator, an efficient cause, distinct and different from the world itself. So, the creator is immanent, in everything He has created, which means Creator and creation are the same. This is the idea is explained in this small dialogue. So this boy asked the question, say, Athihi bhagavo brahmedi, this is the Upanishad statement, please teach me Brahman. By Brahman, the boy meant the origin of the universe, the mystery of the universe. What is behind all this visible, changing phenomena? Now, the father doesn't ask the boy to believe in anything. He asks him, look around, see what you see around. So if you look around, what do you see? You see only material objects, mountains, seas, valleys, oceans, sky, clouds, and so on. You think and you imagine, what is its source? Where do they come from? And what is the power that sustains them? And then what will happen to them in future? What will be their destiny? Yatova imani bhudani jayante yena jatani jivanti yat prayant abhisamvishanti tad vijignasasva tad brahma. You see, almost similar to Socratic dialogues. Plato, of course, Plato has recorded. But, you know, the last portion is missing in Socrates. See, after explaining this, the father tells his son, find out where do these external phenomena come from? What sustains them? Where are they going to? What will be their destiny? Find out this truth yourself through inward meditation. That last part is this the unique feature of the Upanishad. Tapasa Brahma Vidignyasasva. That is the last part of the instruction which the father, the saint, gives to the son. Yatova imani bhudani jayante yena jatani jivanti ye prayant abhisamvishanti tad vijnyasasva tad brahma. Tad vijnyasasva means through inward meditation he find out what is the source behind all this. He is not asked to believe in anything. So this boy started meditating. After some days of meditation, he thought matter is the only reality in the world. What you see with your eyes, what you perceive with your five senses of perception is the only reality. There is nothing beyond this. That is the first stage in human philosophical inquiry, also spiritual inquiry. What you see, you believe. Not anything beyond the visible, beyond the empirical, beyond the present. But then father said, no, no, you are wrong. So, annam brahmedi vijana, annam means matter. That's how he replied. I understand matter is behind everything. Matter is the source. Matter is the sustaining principle. And matter is the ultimate goal of the entire cosmic phenomena. The father said, you are wrong. Continue your meditation. After meditating for some time, this boy thought, vital energy is the ultimate source of everything. Because everything manifests in the form of energy. Without energy, there can be nothing. And energy is indestructible. It can only change its form. Father said, no, you are wrong. Then after still a long on meditation, may have taken several days. It's not that one on the same day. It's spread over several months perhaps. The boy thought, it is mind which creates everything. When something is in your mind, like kind of subject to idealistic theory, philosophy, Berkeley or Buddhist Vijnanavadins and all that. Mind is the source of everything. Mind sustains everything. When something vanishes from mind, everything is gone. The father said, you are wrong. Again, the fourth stage of meditation, the boy discovered, rather he thought, that it is the intellect which is the source of everything. That also, father was wrong. Father corrected him. See, intellect and mind cannot be very different. And then the boy meditated for a longer period. And through long meditation, he discovered that there is something which is beyond the present, beyond the matter, the energy, the mind and intellect, which is beyond definition, beyond words, beyond explanation, beyond description, which can only be experienced. And when you experience it, you feel that you have got something beyond which there is nothing to seek. You have got something beyond which there is nothing that you could achieve in this world. And you know, when the boy came, he was silent. Then the father understood he had reached the truth. Now, the boy got an intuitive experience of inner bliss. He felt, well, within him there is something which goes beyond body, beyond mind, beyond intellect, beyond matter. That is in the form of an infinite bliss. Now, this is the style that you find in Upanishad literature. Now, of course, there are innumerable dialogues. Some of them I have already dealt with on earlier occasions. The Chandogya, Brihadaranyaka, and so on. Now I shall come to Brahma Sutras. As I said, whatever is stated in the Upanishadic text is subjected to relentless, ruthless, logical analysis in Brahma Sutras, which I said earlier consist of 555 pithy statements. See, Brahma Sutra, Brahma means ultimate reality. Sometimes it is called Vedanta Sutras. Vedanta means the essence of knowledge. Veda means knowledge. Anta means the conclusion, the final word, the essence of knowledge. Now, it is a book which consists of not even phrases. Tattu samanyayat and so on, you know. All that Shastra Yonitvat, and so on. There are quite a few. I won't go through those details. Now, the author of this Brahma Sutra is supposed to be Vyasa. And Vyasa wrote these Brahma Sutras. It is said that altogether in early days, there were 20 chapters. 12 chapters of the original sutras came to be known as Purva Mimamsa Sutras, which deal with karma, kanda, mimamsa, external rituals, etc. 12 chapters. And 4 chapters of the sutra literature came to be known as Vedanta Sutras or Brahma Sutras, which is attributed to Vyasa. And between them, there were 4 sutras which dealt with different aspects related to different deities of the spiritual pantheon. I won't go into those details. I shall come to Brahma Sutra. In Brahma Sutra, the statements of Chandogya Upanishads are predominantly subjected to analysis. Most of the quotations are from Chandogya Upanishad. The period is, of course, the exact period in which these sutras were written is still debated. But great Indologists like Jacobi, Vindernitz, Keith, and Max Muller, they have different opinions with regard to the period of these Brahma Sutras, extending from, say, 1300 BC up to 400 BC. So this is the time range, the period during which these sutras came into existence. As it's obvious that the sutras came into existence, They were formulated long after the Upanishadic literature had already become well known. So, of the famous commentaries, the most well-known commentaries are the commentaries of Shankara, Ramanuja, and Madhva. Shankaracharya, the teacher of the non-dualistic system of philosophy, establishes that the supreme truth The Supreme Reality is one impersonal, attributeless reality which is immanent not only in all human beings but also in the entire creation. And it is also omnipresent, it is all-pervading, it is also transcendental. He doesn't refute, he doesn't reject the possibility of a God with a form and with certain attributes. But he says, as you evolve further in spiritual and metaphysical evolution, you get a more holistic, complete view of the reality. As Swamiji said, you know, Vivekananda said, we are not traveling from error to truth, but from truth to truth, from truth that is from lesser truth to higher truth. It's not that one view is wrong or and the other view is right. One view may be a partial view. Another view may be a more complete view. And Swamiji also stated, we are traveling from dualism towards non-dualism, but we had to pass through the intermediary stage of qualified non-dualism. So all these commentaries are still studied. And now we'll come to Bhagavad Gita. That is the third foundation. In fact, Upanishads is the foundational text of the triple canons, and Gita and Brahma Sutras enjoy almost equal status, because as you understand, both of them are dependent upon the teachings of the Upanishad. Brahma Sutras logically analyze the teachings of the Upanishads. Gita, in a way, is a commentary on the teachings of the Upanishads. The point is, if Upanishads give you the metaphysical, the theoretical dimension, Gita helps you to find out a way to practice and to translate the Upanishad truths into day-to-day life, into individual life, family life, social life, and also national life. So Gita is full of ideas which are very helpful in all our day-to-day life situations. How to work, how to pray, how to combine prayer and work, and how to combine meditation and work. Because Gita addresses a person in his day-to-day life situation. It is very practical. On the one hand, it contains the highest metaphysics, the highest spiritual ideas. That's called Brahma Vidya, it is called. So if you read Gita at the end, you find Brahma Vidyayam Yoga Shastra. These two terms you find at the end of each chapter. Which means Gita contains Brahma Vidya, which means the highest spiritual path. How to lead a spiritual life, whether you are working as a professor or you are a person trying to find out the truth through meditation, or if you are just a philosophical inquirer, just a seeker of truth, whatever may be your position, depending upon our attitudes, aptitudes, temperaments, and characteristics, we can choose some practical means to attain the supreme spiritual enlightenment. For that, Gita prescribes four paths. And these paths are known as four yogas: Raja Yoga, Karma Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Jnana Yoga, which constitute the technology of spiritual inquiry. If Upanishads provide you the science, Gita provides you the technology. Because Gita comes down to the level of the common man. And as I said earlier, Gita also addresses mankind, humanity. Gita is not the text of any particular nation, religion, group, or anything. Gita is very universal. Here also, it will be interesting to note that it was Shankaracharya's commentary which turned Gita from an ordinary text into a sublime universal spiritual classic. We have to remember, we have no less than 18 small works known as Gita spread over the huge classic of Mahabharata, which, as I said earlier, contains 100,000 verses. And Gita is only 700 verses, remember. Now, like that, as I said, there are many Gitas, many small poetical, metrical works spread over certain Puranas like Bhagavata Purana, Mahabharata, and so on. But Gita became a unique, universal spiritual classic because of the masterly touch of Shankaracharya. Swamiji points out that part in the Sages of India. And there have been many commentaries on Gita before Shankaracharya. But after Shankaracharya's commentary came into existence, all other commentaries practically faded into insignificance. Just as in the case of Brahma Sutras. Now, I have given a brief outline of these triple foundations. A few more important points which I want to repeat are this. In Vedantic tradition, not only in philosophy, in spiritual tradition, and also in customs and manners, it is the statements of the Upanishads which are the final authority. I can give certain examples. See, you know very well that we have a group of texts which are laws, like constitutions. They're called smritis, you know. Upanishads are called the srutis, and sruti means the eternal, spiritual, metaphysical ideas containing in the Upanishad literature. Smritis are laws, like constitutions. A number of such laws or constitutions were written between 1500 BC and 300 BC, almost within a period of 12 centuries. The smritis of Manu, Yajnavalkya, Parashara, Narada, Jabala, Vyasa, and so on. Now, if you read these smritis, sometimes you will be pleased, sometimes you will be shocked. There are grand ideas in these smritis. See, yatra naryastu pujante ramante tatra devataha, yatra yadastuna pujante tatra sarva phalakriya, a statement in Manusmriti. You know what it means? It means, see, the high status of women in ancient India is clearly stated here. Wherever women are honored, respected, and considered to be on an equal status with the menfolk, there, the society, the family, the nation flourish. Wherever they are not honored, that nation, the society perish. Wherever they are honored, the society, the nation will flourish. And wherever they are not honored, the nation will perish. Just the opposite. So they should be honored. They should be given an exalted position in society. This is a statement of Manusmriti. The same Manusmriti says in another context, just opposite, asutantra sriyakarya purushe swer divanisham visheshu sa sajjandya samsthapya atmanovase. Same Manu says in another context that ladies should not be given any freedom. They should be kept under restraint control. This is the same lawgiver makes a statement, the same text. According to some philologists and scholars, some of these are interpolations which later were put in that Smriti literature by some people with some their own wonderful ideas or imaginations and so on, you know, undesirable ideas were interpolated. They were added to this Smriti literature.
Now, how do we decide which portion, which part of this law is relevant or to be taken seriously? So we have to listen to what the Upanishad say. Upanishad should be taken as the final and the supreme authority, wherever there are different views among different smritis. So because Upanishad say that, Upanishad in the Yajurveda, Sattva Brahmana, there is a statement, Ithayamam Kalyanim Vajam Brahmarajanyabhyam Avadani, like that, there is a statement here, Sudraya Swaya Aryaya Charana, like that, there are some statements. The statement says, these great sublime truths, these Upanishads, these universal spiritual truths should be spread among all people, should be taken to all people, and all people are equally fit to receive these great ideas. They should be preached among all people. So what I want to drive home is, in Vedantic tradition, the Upanishads are the supreme authority. As happens in many ancient civilizations, you know, during the early days, there were certain books which contained ideas which were certainly diabolical in their nature. But the greatness of Vedantic tradition is Vedanta opens its doors and windows to all people, irrespective of race, gender, nation, culture, and so on. In fact, two of the greatest philosophers of Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, and that's the greatest Upanishad, are two women philosophers, Gargi and Maitreyi. So I have given just a bird view of some aspects of the triple foundations of Vedanta, that is Upanishads, Brahma Sutras, and Gita. The one point which I want to stress again and again is, in Vedantic tradition, it is what the Upanishads teach that is to be taken seriously as a final and supreme authority. And Upanishads are universal in nature. It opens its doors and windows to everyone, irrespective of nation, color, language, race, gender, culture, anything. That is why great Western thinkers like even American transcendentalists, Thoreau and Whitman, they happen to read, they happen to know of the Upanishads from thinkers and from ideas which were floating from Europe. It was Schopenhauer who first opened the doors of the greatness of Upanishads to the Western Hemisphere. So it is clearly stated in many books that even modern American transcendentalist movement was inspired by the universal ideas of the Upanishads, because Upanishads go beyond everything. Upanishads are full of manly, vigorous, and universal ideas, which if we practice, we can enjoy peace of mind, and tranquility. It will make us a better human being, because it teaches us to look at entire creation, the entire humanity as one spiritual family. That is the greatness of the Upanishad literature. I have given just a brief outline of the triple foundations. So, thank you. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om. That's Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.